organization, that they'll get this reputation for, yeah, they represent a certain number of workers, but the workers really aren't making that much money. That used to be the textile industry before it practically disappeared, hotel industry and others. And, you know, there are exceptions, but they would go into companies basically say, look, this is our wages comparable to yours. And even in union places, and you're non-union, we just want to get our foot in the door and give the workers some rights to a grievance procedure and collect dues, you know. And, well, guess what? That's not enough. You know, there have been plenty of unions broken, especially in the building trades, but also others where management realized the union wage had gotten so low that they could match it or come close to it or go a little bit above it and then show that to the workers. And then the workers would say, and I'm not saying this is right, but the workers would say, what do we need a union for? We're getting the same amount of money or less being in the union. And that's a way to break a union right there. So if the unions don't fight, which they haven't, a lot of them, if they go in with concessionary bargaining, they're just digging a deeper and deeper hole for themselves, because at a certain point, management will be able to temporarily match the union. And you can all day go up to the workers and say, well, with your benefits, you're actually making more. But that doesn't work. You know, wages and money is pretty much the unifying issue, because not everyone uses the benefits the same way. Younger workers don't use the health benefits as much. Older workers aren't going to, necessarily use other benefits. And maybe wages doesn't make as much for that moment, make as much a be as important. But wages do tend to be important and do tend to be a unifying issue for everyone to a certain extent in a workplace. And that's what the union is ultimately judged on, fair or not. Now, some workers can wrap their heads around the idea that, well, if I wasn't here, I wouldn't get health care. The union negotiated that. That's fair. That's true. But even for them, what's happening now is the health care, the pensions and stuff like that, that you want to say to the workers, if you're a union bureaucrat who doesn't want to fight for more wages, you want to say, look at your benefits. Ooh, well, those are being taken away now. So what do you have to look at? What does the worker have to look at in terms of union representation? The wages have to stay higher, much higher than management. And the figures still say that's the case with unionization overall. But then there are places where that's not the case, unfortunately. And that's where the unions get broken faster and sooner than other places. It's top of the hour. I have to give our legal representation here, whatever the word is, announcement, part of the FCC rules here. This is WMFO Medford, WMFO in Medford. And we refer to ourselves as Tufts Freeform, commercial-free, community-based radio, WMFO 91.5 FM, also known as Tufts Educational Radio. And this is Socialist Alternative Radio, and you're listening to 91.5 FM WMFO Medford Tufts Freeform Radio. So that's a lot of self-identification there. Go to WMFO.org for more information and to listen by your computer and so on and so forth. So, but also, stay abreast of, stay in touch with, stay informed of, about the Stop and Shop workers here in New England. United Food and Commercial Workers, UFCW Local 1445. Could Google that or whatever to get the latest info. Representing 10,000 Stop and Shop workers in New England. They deserve your support, my support, all workers' support. And speaking of the whole tie-in between unions and living standards and all that, there's more than one economist out there saying, why after the Great Recession have workers not benefited from the recovery, and they trace it back to the continuing weakness of unions, the continuing downturn and decline in union power in the U.S. This is a story that caught my eye, and you might have heard about this. I'm not sure how much it's going around the corporate or alternative media or the social media or whatever. I think I might have seen it actually on Facebook, but I remember seeing the original story, too, or stories like it, where part of the inequality that's happening in this country, in the United States, that's so horrible, is you have these pockets of extreme wealth. Boston, by the way, is part of that. Boston, in general, is a place where the rich are more numerous than they are in other places, and upper middle class is more numerous than in other places, drawn by the universities drawn by some high tech, and therefore there's a certain amount of gentrification going on in the neighborhoods, and overall it's getting to be a much more expensive place to live. And that trend has started ever since I blew into town, actually, in the early 80s, and it has continued unabated, and at times it rushes through and becomes increased, and that's happening now. Rents are going up terribly in Boston, forcing a lot of people into ridiculously crowded living situations or having to move further and further out. Now I'm raising my hand on that one. Basically, other pockets like this include Silicon Valley in California. And I've seen a number of stories of people that the rich want to exploit in Silicon Valley, people that sell food, people that clean, people that do landscaping, yard work, people that they want to deliver things, et cetera, et cetera. But those people, that huge workforce, and fix things, you know, all the things that working people do to keep the place running, keep the whole economy running, actually. And yet they're only paying their like high level technicians enough money to, live in the area. If maybe that's not even true, but a certain number of them are getting enough money to live in the area. So the others, all those other people that they want to exploit, the rich want to exploit, can't afford to live in the area. And they have these ridiculous commutes, or they live in, or they're homeless sometimes, or they live, in really bad situations. And basically, you've probably heard of Yelp, the people that do, isn't that the restaurant review thing? I think it is. And probably other stuff, other cutesy stuff for the, latest in screen watching and button pressing. So Silicon Valley tech worker fired after blogging about starving while working at billion-dollar food delivery firm. Okay, so Yelp is a food delivery firm. Got it. So this is from Alternet. February 21st, Bethany Palma Marcus, also from Raw Story. A fired employee from the Silicon Valley tech firm Yelp has raised anger over the $1.38 billion company's labor practices after writing a blog that pointed out that the profitable company's employees are struggling to survive. So she wrote something about how low her pay is, how much that stinks, especially in a company that's making billions. All the Harvard workers could write something like this too, by the way. And she, like her other coworkers, are just struggling to hang on. And wait till you hear what some of the stuff she had to go through here to live near or in Silicon Valley and go to this job every day. The employee, known as Talia Jane Online, posted on her Medium blog that many employees can't make basic living expenses. In an open letter to the company's CEO, Jeremy Stoppelman, that's the CEO of Yelp, according to a magazine called Business Insider, Talia Jane was fired from her post as a customer service agent in Yelp. And so her letter that she sent out originally complaining about her living conditions includes, she went to college, and it's true of many what are known as millennials who have found themselves after in this situation after leaving college. Quote, so here I am. This is the woman that was fired for daring to exercise her free speech rights about how she's living, working in this big profitable corporation. So here I am, 25 years old, balancing all sorts of debt, that would be college debt, etc., and trying to pave a life for myself that doesn't involve crying in the bathtub every week. Every single one of my coworkers is struggling. They're taking side jobs. They're living at home. One of them started a GoFundMe because she couldn't pay her rent. So, again, going back to the article, it seems San Francisco-based Yelp didn't appreciate her essay. More than 2 hours after posting it, Talia went on Twitter to say she had been fired. She had been paid just over $733 biweekly and was paying $1,245 monthly for rent. So I did the math really quick. That's take home, if that's net, we're talking about, or it's take home of $1,468, but your rent is $1,245. So if you ever live that, and I have, I moved into a place in East Cambridge one time. I think I had broken up with someone or something and had to you know, find a place, or I just, no, maybe I'd just been kicked out of a place I was in for a long, long time. And I reduced my carbon footprint, as they like to say. I threw out so much stuff I wanted to keep in order to fit into this tiny little apartment in East Cambridge in what was then still kind of a rough neighborhood. And I probably changed since then. But anyway, there I am in this little apartment, and I have very little stuff, and some of it's in storage. And I'm paying, though, over $1,000 in rent. And I had other debts, and I'm taking home a certain amount of money, and I realized, like, so much of my money is going to rent that I have to watch every penny. And the whole time I was there, I had to do that. That's just one example of many, rental experiences I had with at the tender mercies of various landlords around Greater Boston, who, by the way, have no limit to their greed. And it doesn't matter if they are, you know, usually doesn't matter if they are family, you know, kind of somewhat working class. Unfortunately, the working class often gets divided, and this is one way that it happens among a certain section of the working class, is that, all of a sudden you're a landlord and, you know, getting gobs of money in a place like Boston for renting out a couple floors of a triple decker you probably inherited from your grandfather or something. I did have one situation, one or two I can think of in my life, where I actually did get class solidarity, did actually trump incredibly high rent, and I was given rent below. I was made to pay rent below the market value of the rental at that point in time, so to speak. But you can't count on that, I learned too. So she goes on to say, this is the woman that Silicon Valley tech worker fired after blogging about her starving while working at this billion-dollar food delivery firm. Get the irony there. She goes on to say, I make $8.15 an hour after taxes. So apparently Silicon Valley hasn't had its $15 an hour minimum wage movement yet, which it desperately needs. Or the whole state of California, obviously. They just passed it in Los Angeles. It should go statewide now, and San Francisco and Richmond, California. Actually, California's ready. Statewide $15 minimum wage now. That's what I say. Anyway, she says, I haven't bought groceries since I started this job. Not because I'm lazy, but because I got this 10-pound bag of rice before I moved here. My meals at home, including the one I'm having as I write this, consist by and large of that, of rice, because I can't afford to buy groceries. Business Insider says her letter and firing have led to an outpouring of support, including people donating to her PayPal account to help. They don't say how much, though. I'm not sure that really is going to help that much. So let me try to take this phone call here. WMFO, you're on the air. WMFO, you're on the air.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Diego.
Hey, sorry I couldn't make it, man. When I woke up, I had a flat.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
The rest of my life.
Just for our listeners' context here, Diego sometimes co-hosts the show, and he was going to come in today, and we had some news we wanted to talk about. And why don't we save that, though, if you don't mind, because you're a little, yeah. It's a little, the connection's not that great. Let's be in touch about the next show, and I would love to have you on if you can make it.
Yeah,
and
hopefully by then we'll know what's happening with my DUA situation.
Also, but like I said, Diego, you don't have to come in for the whole show if that's a hassle. Just come in for part of it, but whole show's fine too.
Like I said, I was going to go today, but then obviously I don't have my flat, and the place that fixes my flat is closed on Sunday. So
yeah, well, I'll hold off on talking about your situation. But did you hear about Stop and Shop workers might go on strike?
No.
Yeah, they might. I'm not sure. They're having a meeting today. They might not go on strike, but they might. And I was just talking about that over the air.
I'm looking towards applying to.
Yeah. Well, if they go on strike, obviously, don't go in. But
I know. I don't want to get scared.
Right. But anyway, I just thought I'd let you know that because I thought maybe you were not able to listen today. So let's be in touch and come on the next show, hopefully, okay?
Okay, yeah, definitely.
All right, thanks for calling in, Diego. Appreciate
it. All right, comrade.
Yeah, take care. Bye. Okay, that was Diego. Sorry for the, bad connection there. Sometimes we just talk over the phone. on the show, but it's better when he's in the studio. And we do have some kind of big news that, well, kind of unfortunate news, but big news that we want to talk about and make a big subject on today's show. We'll make it next time, hopefully, a big subject on the show. Continuing with this woman that got fired for just complaining about how greedy her company is and how low her pay was. She says things got so bad while at Yelp, where she was working, the food delivery giant, and review, I guess Yelp reviews or whatever. Things got so bad she woke up with hunger pains. Now, if you ever had hunger pains, it's this weird thing where you really do, like, this churning in your stomach is very, very real, and you feel it, and you get headaches and all this other stuff, and then it goes away a little bit. You think, oh, I can stand this, and all of a sudden it comes back again. It's nature's way of reminding you that you need to eat to survive, and when you can't afford to, it is so horrible, especially if you're, obviously, so, you know, here's someone telling you starving or almost starving or whatever, being hungry is horrible, right? You don't need to hear that. You know it's horrible, right? Well, I don't know. I'm not a big believer of you have to experience every last thing to understand it. I do believe in the power of imagination and empathy, for example. I do believe writers can write about things they don't directly experience and still do a good job of explaining what those things are like. But then there are certain things, certain categories of things that it does help to have, I think, experience them to completely, or, you know, very close to completely understanding them. And so hunger is one of those. And I don't claim to have experienced it at the level of a lot of people in the world, or maybe the majority of people in the world. But I've experienced it, unfortunately. And it really sucks, obviously. And I'm just mentioning it to what it feels like, in case you haven't, and also to put this some context into this person's story. I mean, what you're going to hear, the next part you're going to hear, it makes perfect sense, actually, what she says. She backs off from the hunger thing for a second. She goes, I brought up the wages, meaning the low wages, in every quarterly meeting I had with my manager, she said. They were well aware that I was struggling despite doing what I could with what I had. The last straw was when I woke up yesterday, 2 hours after going to sleep, because my stomach hurt from hunger. That was the part I was alluding to that I remember when I read this earlier, that it can be so bad that it overtakes everything. That need to eat and the churning in your gut just takes over everything. And that kind of empty pain, I don't know how to explain it because pain's not empty, but that is that's something you have to find something to eat. You know, they talk about people driven mad by hunger. Yes, that's true. You know, and when you read these stories of cannibalism and so on, I always say to myself, I would never become a cannibal. I don't care. I'd starve to death first. That's quite a thing to say. That's quite an arrogant thing to say in some ways. I hope it's true. But the amount of willpower it would take to ignore the pain of hunger over time is incredible. It's just incredible. I can believe it happening, but the suffering would be just beyond what a lot of people could handle, probably myself as well. So she goes on to say, it's, meaning hunger, something I'm used to, these hunger pains. But this time, when she woke up after 2 hours with hunger pains, it was really driving me to put something in my stomach immediately. I couldn't wait 15 minutes for my rice to cook because she had been living off of like a bag of rice, she mentioned at one point, which I didn't read that part. And I couldn't wait for the rice to cook, so it all became very clear that this shouldn't be an issue I was dealing with, to the point where I forgot it wasn't normal. And the rest of the article is like this person, this journalist, all of a sudden talking about like, things are bad in other places too, and it's hard to even explain. It just goes all over the place. But she did make a connection. She did quote what the company said. The company goes, this is the CEO response. Yelp and its CEO responded to Talia's letter and firing. We agree with her comments about the high cost of living in San Francisco, which is why we announced, Silicon Valley in San Francisco, I don't know, which is why we announced in December that we are expanding our Eat24 customer support team into our Phoenix office, where we will pay the same wage. where we'll pay the same wage. Into our Phoenix office where we'll pay. That doesn't make any sense. Oh, well. See, that's another thing. They cut back. Journalism these days is like very pared down, and I guess they can't afford proofreading very much. So Yelp issued a statement about this that sounds completely insane. I don't know. I don't quite even know how to understand it. They're expanding our Eat 24 customer support team. I see. Moving to Phoenix will be cheaper than living in San Francisco, I guess is what they're talking about. Well, again, that probably depends on where you end up in Phoenix and what you're doing. Anyway, speaking of rich getting richer, poor getting poorer, counterpunch.org, February 26th, Rick Baum, B-A-U-M. During Obama's presidency, wealth inequality has increased and poverty levels are higher. And I don't, have time to get into this totally, but here's a little factoid. During the presidencies of Bush Sr., Clinton, G.W. Bush, and Obama, a greater portion of the nation's wealth has become more concentrated in the hands of the rich, as indicated by the share of wealth held by the top 1%. Now, why is that interesting? You notice I just rattled off four names of presidents. Well, two of them are Republican and two of them are Democrat. So if you're going to put all your hope in Bernie Sanders or some other Democrat, think again, despite the rhetoric. From 1989 to 2013, the share of the top 10% went from 67.2% to 75.2%, or slightly over two-thirds more than three-quarters of the nation's total wealth. And I lived during those years, obviously, and I saw that. I saw that happening. I've paid attention to these statistics for a long time. This one, like, goes at it from different angles, not too different, but for example, despite the last few years of recovery, the share of wealth held by the bottom 50% of the U.S. population declined from 1.15%, which is almost nothing, obviously, in 2010 to 1.05% in 2013. This is less than half of where it stood in 2007 before the Great Recession, when the share of the country's wealth held by the poorest 50% of the population was at 2.5%. Woo-wee, 2.5%, but now it's even less. So, and by the way, if you think that, organizing for socialism, for social change is about waiting until things get so horrible that people have to fight back, that's wrong on a number of levels, because there's no sort of bottom line through which the capitalist class won't go down to and then through. They will drive you into the dirt if they can get away with it. And then a lot of workers will look up from that dirt and say, well, at least we have dirt. And some other workers, like in some other country or something, might be underwater or something. You know what I mean? It's just like this race to the bottom. When I'm on Facebook, which is a big, big time thing, unfortunately, that I've been cutting back on lately and need to cut back even further. You get into arguments with people. Often for me, it's arguments about $50 minimum wage, because invariably when something goes up on a big $15 minimum wage post, like one initiated by Fight for 15 or something, there's always people trolling it that will come in and say, I worked my way up from blah, blah, and why should someone get paid what I get paid, I don't flip burgers. I do, and often they don't really say what they do, which is interesting, and they don't say exactly how much they make, which is interesting, but you get the point, right? It's the bootstraps argument, the old Horatio Alger myth, supposedly given legitimacy by real-life stories, And when I was organized for unions at times, and I get this to a certain extent organizing, organizing people into socialist alternative, you get to know people a little bit, and you find out, especially with the union organizing, since you're talking to people that that are going to remain pretty conservative, even if they join the union or not, you talk to people who, their stories don't hold up. Let's just put it that way. It's not that people are lying necessarily. It's just that their conception of reality is skewed. It has no context. There's no, for example, historical memory in the U.S. is very, very weak, right? As everybody knows, a huge ignorance about history. And they want to say it's because of the educational system. And they're right. Some people that pay attention to that say they're right. It is the educational system. Because the educational system is a capitalist education system where short-term maximization of profit is God. So the education system is to get you ready to get exploited. Whether it's the high end of exploitation or to rule, if you go to Harvard, you become part of the new ruling class or part of that grade or section of Harvard. And then on down to the trained, you know, professions and so on, down to the lowest, so-called lowest part of the economic rung, where they just want you to be used to the sound of a bell means you move somewhere else, or respect authority figures like your teacher or something like that. You know, it can get very basic what the corporations want education to do for them, you know. And of course, people fight back and try to make education more interesting and more real. And for other purposes than selling your labor to the corporations, all that, right? But there's also just the fact that you can, that the outside of the education system, what you learn from in other countries, from like the existence of, say, workers' parties, even if they've degenerated, communist, socialist, labor parties. There's sort of like this the historical memory is a little higher. The class consciousness is a little higher among a lot of workers. It's not uniform or anything, obviously. And it can be still very low class consciousness. But the idea that, you know, you grew up in a country where at one point a political party was started by working people through unions or whatever, through a revolutionary party or both, to represent working people. They didn't take any money from the big corporations. That existed at one time. Even if it doesn't anymore necessarily. And you find that out through some sort of rotten education or semi-rotten education, or you find that out on your own through reading or through people talking. That puts you sort of higher, on a higher plane of consciousness and understanding of things a little bit, hopefully, and not in every case, than the average U.S. worker who has nothing to point to. They don't know that, most workers don't know. It's not their fault. They don't know that a mass socialist party existed around the turn of the 20th century and for, 10, 15 years. And that's not the greatest example, but it is an example. And then since then, you haven't had a political party outside the realm of the Democrats and Republicans that's become a mass party. So we're so infantilely challenged here. We're such children politically in the United States because we go begging to the Democratic and Republican parties for everything, and those are the parties of big business. Those are the corporate parties. We never had our own party as working people, as the 99% or whatever. And that is a huge weakness, and it affects consciousness in a huge way. And even someone like Sanders, who runs putting forward some good ideas, doing it within the framework of the Democratic Party leads to, for example, I'll read, this is again an article I was reading from about wealth inequality under Obama, that it has increased, so has poverty. Again, Rick Baum, B-A-U-M, from counterpunch.org. He writes, quote, "If in 2008, one hoped for the presence of more poor people and for a greater concentration of wealth in the hands of the rich, so far during Obama's presidency, these hopes have been fulfilled." That's if you're really nasty and wanted to see poverty increase. "They will presumably continue were a Republican elected president." So he's like being sarcastic, of course. "Should one," it'll continue with both Democrat and Republican. "Should one also expect more of the same from Hillary Clinton, who wants to build, quote, on the progress the president has made," meaning Obama. So all this stuff that was happening recently about hyping Obama, remember there was a point in the debates where Clinton was accusing Sanders of attacking Obama and how sacrosanct Obama's record was, and some bourgeois capitalist pundits, journalists and so on, were saying that in South Carolina that and I'm not sure this is true yet, but that most African-American voters voted in the Democratic Party primary voted for Clinton, and Clinton being more snuggly with Obama, supposedly, that might be a factor, or a mythology about what Clinton did, whatever. But here's the additional thing with this problem. Bernie Sanders, and I'm quoting from the article, "or Bernie Sanders, who thinks Obama, quote, has done an excellent job," unquote. So either way, with what's shaping up to be the Democratic Party nominees, probably Clinton, obviously, but not totally ruled out that Sanders might sneak in there, that they're both extolling the virtues of the Obama administration, where inequality increased and poverty increased, and Sanders supposedly is running a campaign largely about that. So you get these ridiculous contradictions in a political situation where controlled basically by big business, and where no workers' party of any sort, no third party, if you like that term, which we don't like, but if no alternative party is out there yet. And that's what remains to do. That's what working people really need. And it will reinvigorate the unions most likely too. We need to build, not dump everything into the Democrats all the time. You know, like some people are getting really excited, including people in Social Alternative, about labor for Bernie. There are unions out there that have endorsed Sanders. I say, well, okay. To the extent that that's led to them complaining about the undemocratic nature of their union process in choosing a political candidate, I agree, that's progressive. But what doesn't seem progressive to me is that Sanders is running as a Democrat, so it's not that much of a stretch for a union to endorse a Democrat like they usually do. And then if this person loses, they'll just endorse the next Democrat, you know, Hillary, or move on to the next election when more of the lesser evilist crap. And Sanders certainly isn't the first left populist running around, even though he has the socialist label affixed to him by some, which isn't really true, but he has that there. And yet it's like, I don't see that as such a, you know, transgressive, radical thing to just endorse another Democrat, when actually what's been so needed in the U.S. labor movement since the 1920s is to build a mass workers' party, mass socialist party, communist party, labor party, workers' party, whatever you want to call it, but one that at least is anti-capitalist or implicitly so in terms of what it wants, in terms of the demands, like, say, single-payer health care, or more to the point, a national health care system. Much higher minimum wage, even higher than 15, I think, should be on the cards now, although 15 is a good stepping stone, et cetera. You know, demands that it'd be questionable whether they could be achieved under capitalism, but they probably could, but they would take quite a fight, and they would push everything to the left in a progressive direction if taken up in a serious way. So a program for a new party that's to the left of the Democrats easily, but even much more to the left of the Democrats, a structure that is different from the Democratic Republican Party, so not just a register to vote for thing, but a thing with actual membership and democratic structures. That might be too much to ask for, but you know, it's important. And hopefully people would fight for that once a party like that got off the ground. But most importantly, perhaps, given the limited, given the kind of desperate need for this sort of formation, that you can't get everything you want right off the bat. Like, notice I'm not saying it should be a socialist party right off the bat, because I doubt it would be in any real sense. But a mass party that would not be taking any money from the corporations. That's crucial. That's key. Because once that money trail, once that money tie to the big corporations is put in place, it's there, and it rules, you know? So anyway, you might be wondering, since we touched on the elections off and on, who I'm endorsing, who I'm saying we should vote for. And that's a complicated question, because I'm in an organization where the position is right now, in general, there is significant discussion about this, but position is that we should call for Sanders to win and a vote for Sanders. I think the way it's going, and with the problems with Sanders, which are many, mostly running through the Democratic Party, but there are other problems, that we should be more calling for a vote for Jill Stein and the Green Party, mainly Jill Stein, not endorsing the Green Party per se, but just Jill Stein's candidacy, and calling for a vote for her. And as a step towards building a party for working people, like I've been talking about off and on today. And that also can be accomplished by engaging. I'm not saying ignore the Sanders campaign or anything, but engaging the Sanders campaign on the issues that there's some commonality around in terms of socialist transitional demands and what Sanders putting forward, specifically, and there's others, the free education in public schools, the $50 minimum wage, the general talk of inequality, the increased taxes, although Sanders' tax proposals could be a lot better. Increased taxes on the super rich, and I don't see any proposal to increase taxes on the big corporations or to cut military spending, two things that need to be addressed. Now, Sanders might have some things about closing corporate loopholes, but I'm talking about we shouldn't rest at a 34% tax rate on corporations. It should go up to like 40% or more as a transition on its way up. And, other progressive things that Sanders is raising are worth talking about with Sanders supporters and saying, yeah, these are good. But honestly, we stopped short of endorsing him. We stopped short of supporting him, calling for a vote for him. This is my position now, because he is going through the Democratic Party and because of things about his past that indicate he will stay with the Democratic Party, including his promises to Clinton to do so. And then what we really need is a third party. So yeah, there will be members of the Democratic Party, maybe even some Democratic Party politicians that would be open in the future to a alternative political party, a workers' party of some sort. But that doesn't mean we have to endorse their candidates in order to get them, when the time comes, to support that. In fact, the more we endorse Democrats, the more we keep the attention focused on the Democratic Party, and the more we delay building that third party, the Workers' Party, that's so, so important to build. There's a good article, again, in Counterpunch by Paul Street, February 26th, Beyond Campaign Finance Reform. And he goes into all the ways that big money, he quotes William Grider from Who Will Tell the People. And also, I guess Street has his own book called They Rule, the 1% versus Democracy. And he quotes all these ways in which big business controls the electoral system. And, that would have been more relevant earlier in the show when I was talking about why socialists run for why socialists do run for office and why electoral politics is important to socialists. There is some very interesting writing in here, though, I feel like I do have to talk about for a second, or just maybe give a quick quote. In terms of this general analysis, bits of it I've given before, bits of it I can be found in Material and Socialist Alternative. But what he's saying right now is happening is, he calls it a great compression, I'm reading that the wrong way, I think. He's talking about the post-war upswing. I'll leave out that phrase for a second. In reality, the gains enjoyed by millions of ordinary working U.S. Americans with the help of the popularly elected New Deal were made possible to no small extent by the uniquely favored and powerful position of the U.S. economy and the remarkable profit rates enjoyed by U.S. corporations in the post-World War II world. When that position and those profits was significantly challenged by a resurgent Western European and Japanese economic competition in the 70s and 80s, the comparatively egalitarian trends of post-war America, and he should qualify that more because it really didn't extend much to African Americans and others. But anyway, these were reversed by capitalist elites who had never lost their critical command of the nation's core economic and political institutions. So that's a pretty good Marxist summary without using much Marxist or socialist terminology, which I don't think is a bad thing to do. I think he maybe should have, but anyway. Then he says the radicals, the best organizers, had been expelled from the labor movement in the late 1940s and 1950s. Working class Americans have paid the price ever since. Yeah, that's one thing, one important thing, obviously. For the last four decades, wealth and income have been sharply concentrated upward, returning to pre-Great Depression levels, making a new or second gilded age that is traceable to a number of regressive and plutocratic policies that have nothing to do with any shift to the right of the populace. And now he's implying an electoral shift or whatever. Along the way, U.S. capitalists, corporations have globalized their production and sales operations like never before in the U.S. as in other nations. Gross inequality and the deepened plutocracy that follows such disparity, I'm not going to finish that metaphor, is a core and all too common, quote, normal, unquote, component of capitalism, understood over the long term. As the liberal French academic rock star Thomas Piketty admits, without crediting the old mole, meaning Karl Marx, that Karl Marx got it right, inequality is deeply rooted in the institutional sinews of capitalism. Also, smart eco-socialists like Joel Covell and John Bellamy Foster remind us of this in terms of environmental catastrophe, which is well underway. Anyway, this is quite a good article. I don't have time to go into it anymore, but it talks about other ways in which elections are controlled and the political system is controlled by big business. A whole list of things. It's quite good. Now, shifting gears really quick. I've got to step away from the mic for a second to get something I forgot to bring up earlier. Sorry for the dead air. That's always nice to hear on radio. Sometimes I have guests and on the show, and we often have interviews on the show, and, you know, people will, they'll talk, you know, they'll think they're doing a good job, and in some ways they probably are. I've never regretted any interview I've done, but they, especially if there's, like, more than two, meaning me and the person being interviewed, they don't, you know, talk enough. Like, I just gave that little pause there for effect. They just don't keep the conversation going. And unless we have some background music playing, which I don't do usually, that's kind of screwed up, because basically you have then dead air. And all radio is noise. It's talk or music or sound effects or something. Anyway, enough of that. Out in Worcester, that second largest city in New England that I mentioned before, where I actually do some, you know, political activity, I just was, you know, there's members of Socialist Alternative at Clark University, and Clark, like every other, Clark is a small liberal arts school, like all colleges, it seems these days, small or large. They are just relentlessly every year increasing tuition. And this is on top of tuition costing, you know, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000. So if you increase tuition in a certain percentage, like you'll see from this leaflet, this is why I'm mentioning this, just to give you some context, based on the large amount that already costs, that is pretty devastating, because you jump up thousands of dollars in a small percentage increase. So here's like an agitational flyer that Elizabeth, I'll give a shout out to her, she made up in Clark, a Clark student named Elizabeth, and she wrote, and we've been putting this up around Clark, but you could put this up any campus practically. Clark increases tuition by 2.9%. And they very quietly let this be known over the last couple of weeks that the tuition's going up. Some students don't even know about it yet, I've heard. Clark increases room and board by 1.4%. What does that mean for you? So get this clear now. Clark tuition up 2.9%, room and board up 1.4%. Together, but you know, what's that, 3.3, 3.4, whatever. Or is it 4.4? Wait a minute. 13. That's all right. Well, let's just do the stupid math instead of just guessing. Sad that I can't do this in my head, but I can. I just want to get it right. I swear. All right. So, yeah. Okay. So we got like a 4.3% increase between the two things. And of course, other things are always going up too. We'll leave that aside. Textbooks, food costs, all sorts of stuff. Well, food is room and board, but anyway. Food costs outside of the university. Anyway, so this agitational flyer goes on to say, this increase of the 2.9% tuition, 1.4% room and board, equals $1,360, not including the amount of the increase that varies by room type. So apparently they have different types of rooms you can pay more for. Sounds like a hotel, right? So that amount of $1,360 can buy 2 years of food stamps for one. Shows you, on the other hand, how bad food stamps is, but on the other hand, how much that is. 19.5 weeks of work study. That's at $10 an hour working 7 hours a week. 29 concerts, assuming the average ticket price of $46.69, which is high. High, not because it's inflated price here, but it's just too much. 657 gallons of gasoline. 209.5 hamburgers from the Bistro, which is a place to eat on campus there. 14 years of Netflix streaming subscription. So where's all this money going? Demand financial transparency. Demand tuition freeze and reduction. Demand reinstatement of need-blind admission, something they had at Clark and they quietly got rid of a couple years ago. And $15 an hour minimum wage. Demand better. Worcester Socialist Alternative. Worcester Social Alternative on Facebook, etc. Ways to get in touch. By the way, anything you hear on the show, you want to talk about more, you want to whatever, write to Socialist Alternative on Facebook, Socialist Alternative Radio, I'm sorry, on Facebook. And to get in touch with Socialist Alternative, just go to socialistalternative.org or go to Socialist Alternative. Actually, I'm not sure what our Facebook address is. Let me look that up quick because I think someone else grabbed Socialist Alternative before we got onto Facebook, which is really not fair. But hold on 1 second. Facebook, Socialist/Socialist Alternative USA. Twitter, @SocialistAlt. info@socialistalternative.org. Email. Here in New England, phone numbers listed. This is from Socialist Alternative, from our newspaper, which is also online, called Socialist Alternative. For example, Worcester, 617-285-9346, 617-285-9346 for Worcester. If you want more information about getting involved out there, Boston, 910-639-3948. Okay, speaking more of the way they're going after us, they being the capitalists, and including at Stop and Shop, as I mentioned earlier, there's just this general, I don't know, you've probably noticed it in the corporate media, this is general open season on pensions, and that's been going on for years now. And it just really boggles the mind when you think about it clearly. People are hired in based on a legalistic arrangement in union and non-union that you have, one of your benefits is a pension plan. And it will accrue at this much and so on. There's actually like laws behind this. And for some reason, and, you know, I'm being sarcastic, this happens actually all the time when it comes to working people. The laws are meaningless when big business wants to attack them. When they want everyone to invest in their stock market gambling through IRAs and other types of pension funds rather than defined benefit pensions like we used to have. If they want to cut pensions on city workers and so on so that they'll pay less taxes, the big business people. It's all just, you can just erase all this money that people are owed. Like in Detroit recently, they just got rid of millions of dollars that workers were owed and they were going to get in their pensions, and now they're not going to get it. So anyone that goes around talking about we're a nation of laws and obey the laws and rule of law and all that, you really have to ask, what planet are you living on? Because obviously laws are, when it comes to working people, laws that we try to deal with and use are just destroyed, torn up in a second when the capitalists decide they're going to make a move like that, locally, regionally, nationally. And pensions are on the chopping block all over the world, basically, for working people. And it's really horrible because one of the biggest areas of poverty before, for example, in the U.S., before the gains of the 30s through the radicalization of the working, of big sections of the working class through the Communist Party and other left groups through protests and so on, and the increase in unionization and all that, one of the things that was happening in the 30s and before that, just read, for example, Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath for a dramatization of this, a fictional dramatization of this. A lot of poor, one of the highest sectors of the workforce in poverty was elderly people. Because once if capitalism has enough labor to draw from, then they're going to get rid of people that start to get old or that are old. so they can exploit faster people that don't have any growing physical limitations or whatever. And under capitalism, if you don't work, you're not worth anything. You really aren't. That's one reason that children are treated so horribly, even in the richest country in the world, here in the U.S. You got less than half the population having children now, so a lot of people just don't care about children, and the way children are treated is just a crime. You know, the limited amount of resources that go into anything to do with healthy child rearing and education is just criminally low in the United States, and pretty low in other places too, but just the United States, ridiculously low. No subsidized daycare on a federal basis. Can you believe that? And what little programs that do exist, Head Start and so on, they're so small, so truncated, always getting cut and stuff, that they're just not nearly enough given the problem. And anyway, shifting from child care, because we talked about that earlier, back to retirement and elder care and so on. I'm quoting from an article in Socialist Alternative published on January 22nd, 2016 by Steve Edwards. This is part of a 40-year assault on the economic security of workers in the U.S. throughout the world. Pensions, the percent of private sector workers getting defined benefit pensions plummeted from 62% in 1979. That's interesting. I thought it was even higher than that, but that isn't even that high. 62% in 1979 to 7% in 2009. Now, that should have caused a revolution right there. Today, less than half of U.S. workers have any kind of pension plan other than Social Security, which, by the way, is nothing almost. I mean, a little better than nothing, which and that itself is under attack and covers only about 40% of what a person needs to retire on. I'd say it covers 20%, but whatever. Maybe Steve Edwards is quoting from something else. Also, 50% of workers have less than $10,000 in savings. And that's also, I think, higher than that. But that gives you a place to start from. And even as we speak, public sector pensions are coming under huge attack internationally. And he gives examples of that, Puerto Rico, Greece, etc., nationally. And this is already resulting in this incredible amount of, and you know, a lot of people are too proud to get into it or whatever, incredible amount of suffering among older people that have worked hard all their lives and have nothing to show for it. No savings, no decent retirement, and at the same time, they want to attack Social Security. So they just keep pushing and pushing, and until there's a real fight back, it doesn't even halt, much less turn around this kind of stuff. And under capitalism, you don't solve it. They're always trying to take everything away. If you had talked to a worker back in the early 80s about, oh, capitalism is so unstable and such a rotten system and such a rapacious system that's going to take away retirement plans, you know, they would have said, oh, no, I know plenty of people with pensions. Now, actually, according to that article I just read an excerpt from, it was only 62% in 79 in defined benefit pensions, and IRAs didn't even exist yet, as far as I remember. So, or to any big extent. So, but people would have argued with you. I mean, I had people 2 years ago arguing with me that $15 an hour was too much. They don't argue that anymore. You know, consciousness does change. It's too bad it takes a long time sometimes. But there are reasons for that aren't under the control of a lot of people. Got to hurry up now. Running out of time. Just want to alert people to a ongoing movement we mentioned before on the show. And I think we've interviewed a member of Socialist Alternative named Seamus Whelan, who came in I think it was a phone interview about this campaign that started. Actually, it's been going on for over a year now. It's called the West Roxbury Lateral Pipeline, or West Roxbury Lateral Whirl, and someone added an S to it, so it's called Swirl. And it's a movement to stop a Texas-based energy corporation named Spectra, which you might have heard of, Spectra Energy, and also Kinder Morgan, to build a pipeline going through West Roxbury, part of Boston, a dense urban neighborhood. And there's already been problems with this sort of pipeline in other areas. And for example, in 2010, a Whirl pipeline, there's a pipeline that exploded in San Bruno, California, in a suburban neighborhood in 2010 in West Roxbury. If this pipeline explodes, it will wipe out 30 blocks of West Roxbury, probably killing hundreds of residents and workers, destroying homes and businesses. So on part of this pipeline goes right by a school, for example. I mean, the whole thing is pretty insane. There's been a big protest movement against it. The mayor hasn't really helped. He came out against it, but he doesn't really done much. The local Democratic Party establishment is getting dragged in to at least talking about this because of the protest movement that members of Social Alternative, by the way, are heavily involved in. So WRL, Spectra Energy, West Roxbury. Look at Social Alternative. The latest issue of the paper has an article on it. It's a growing coalition, and there are other groups involved and individuals. And starts up again April 15th, took a break, this construction of the pipeline, and you're going to see some protests. So you were told about it here first. If you can help out, that would be great. Get in touch with Socialist Alternative. Go to socialistalternative.org. Get in touch with the Boston organization. Look around for SWRL, Swirl, in the area. I don't have a website handy on the article I'm referencing here. There probably is one. But again, go to socialistalternative.org and make your way through the article about that. You can get in touch. So we're pretty much out of time. And we want to thank our listeners locally, internationally, and so on. We had more environmental stuff, more election stuff to go into. We'll tackle it next time. And really, again, thank you for listening. You have been listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class Democratic Socialist Perspective. We're here every other week, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., and to bring you basically a partisan advocacy of democratic socialism and revolutionary socialism as really the only way to reverse and the crisis of capitalism and to create a society where everybody has a decent life and the planet survives as far as human life goes and human habitation goes. And but we bring that all down to the grassroots level as well, and struggles that are happening like the one I just mentioned in West Roxbury and so on. And we want you to not just absorb the information, but actually get involved to change the world to a sustainable democratic socialist society where the economy is planned internationally. And you can read more about that. Start with, you know, Karl Marx and work your way up. Start with Socialist Alternative. Get involved. Get informed. And we're going to go out with some music here. Remember when Bowie passed away recently, David Bowie? I was trying to think, you know, I kind of felt some political stuff in some of his music. I'm not trying to say he was a socialist or anything. In fact, he had a really bad position on Scottish independence. But there was a song I had played on the show years ago that I dug up. Now it's called I'm Afraid of Americans. And maybe we'll have a song or two after that. But right now we're going to go out with Bowie. And again, thanks for listening, and keep up the struggle for socialism.